Well, as you know, we've been speaking to a few people lately who've been deeply involved with and passionate about Australian political life. And the latest memoir to enter this space is by historian and former ALP political advisor and speechwriter Dennis Glover. His book, An Economy Is Not a Society, Winners and Losers in the New Australia, is about growing up in Melbourne's outer suburbs in the 1960s and 70s, in a family of factory workers, and in a working class community that is frankly now gone. In fact, Glover argues, and I quote him, "The transformation from the industrial to the post-industrial era has been so total as to constitute the sociological equivalent of an extinction event." So strong stuff, and the book is full of strong sentiment and argument and loads of passion and a staunch challenge to us to rethink public policy and some of our givens. He joins us now from our Melbourne studio. Good morning and welcome to Saturday Extra, Dennis.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Could you tell us about Doveton, please, the place you grew up, just to give us some context?
Sure. Doveton is a former Housing Commission suburb that was built between the mid-1950s and the mid-1960s. There were past Dandenong, about 25 minutes down the southeastern freeway from Melbourne. It had 2,500 houses, and it was built to house people who worked in a belt of factories along the Princes Highway. And in just three of those huge factories, there were 7,500 jobs. So when I was growing up in Doveton, even though we were working class, we were quite prosperous because there were an average of three jobs to every home. And my father worked in General Motors. My mother worked in Heinz. My sister worked in Heinz. During the university holidays, I worked in Heinz too. And that was pretty typical of us back then. We were working class, but we were by no means poor. But now, those 7,500 jobs have been magically been turned into just 500 jobs by the miracle of economic reform. There's now one job to every five homes, and there's 21.1% unemployment after 25 years of uninterrupted economic growth. And Doveton is full of many successful, hardworking people, but it has become a bit of a social blight. Bit of an unfortunate example of what can go wrong with economic reform.
A few years ago, when your father died, you write that you stood outside your old home, because you don't live in Doveton anymore, of course.
No, I lived there until I was 19 years old, and then my family continued to live in the area, and some of them still do, so I'm, you know, back and forward there regularly.
So you went back, you wept in front of the house, not just for him. Describe what your house has become, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, it used to be a very pleasant street. We were in the newer end of Doveton, built in the late 1960s. Very nice around the corner from us. There was a beautiful little school that we went to, pleasant little strip shopping centre, playgrounds. It's actually a very, very nice place to grow up in the way that young housing estates are. Today, though, with the unemployment, my street has turned into a pretty sad place, you know, rusting cars sitting over everyone's driveways, grass growing up through the cars, you know, curtains closed in the middle of the day. It has a pretty forlorn and sad look of a place that is suffering from long-term unemployment. And, you know, when I went back there and saw the street and then saw the state of the local schools, which is smashed up, and the shopping centres, the picture which came to mind was Detroit in America, where the car factories had shut, there was mass unemployment, and a whole city had started to, you know, fall in on itself.
Well, you have this, it's very evocative because, in fact, you say the occupiers of my little house had gone from builders to wreckers, because they were people who collected junk, as it were, from manufacturers to spare parts sellers, from craftsmen to gleaners in just one generation. Here is the economic progress we were told make us all wealthier, now acting in reverse. Who lives there now in Doveton?
Well, I don't want to talk about individuals who live in houses. I've got the greatest respect for the people who live in my street. I'm sure they're people working hard to try and get on with life. And if they've become, you know, in the wrecking business when they used to actually be in the building business. Well, that's how they choose to make their living. Yes.
What I'm getting at is that you do say it has become a destination. It's got one of the least educated and least qualified populations. A lot of asylum seekers there.
Yes, yes. Well, with
people who can't read English.
Absolutely. With 21.1% unemployment, that's just the official statistic. From talking to the local people, you know, who know and walking around the streets, you get the impression that the people who are not engaged with the workforce are actually a lot higher than that. There's probably people on the disability support pension. The principal of the local school told me that many of the kids going there were the children of, you know, recent refugees and asylum seekers, a lot of people living on welfare.
The school, I'm sorry, this is just all context before we get to your thesis, but the school takes on many of the basic tasks such as feeding the children, many of whom get more than three quarters of their daily nutrition at school.
Yeah, well, what's happened is that Dufton College is this school that's been set up to bring all of the old failing schools together into one school. A lot of money went from philanthropy, and the idea was to create a school that tackles some of the problems faced by the disadvantaged children of the local area. So the children get three meals a day at the school sometimes. It's supposed to be a P-9 school, but in fact it's a birth-9 school, because when I went there, I went into the creche and there were babies. It's an area that tries to tackle all of the social disadvantage of the area in a school. And, you know, I have the greatest respect for the people running the school there. You know, they're angels, these people. But I wonder myself whether bringing all of the disadvantage of a community together in just one spot is the right way to run a school.
Okay, so that's what has got you so upset. And you've essentially, in the final sentence of your book, you challenge readers to ask ourselves if we care, if we really care. What ought to be happening if we do care?
The problem that we have in Australia over the last 25 years is that we've engaged on this experiment in economic reform, which has raised a lot of us up to much higher levels of average prosperity, but has done so in a way that's forgotten about the little people. We've created an economy that used to include everybody in the production and enjoyment of our wealth, and we've changed it to one in which we create our wealth by excluding the people at the bottom. We've destroyed their factories. We've destroyed their jobs. And I think what we need to do is get back to that essential idea of building an economy which makes wealth by including everybody in the production and enjoyment of its wealth. That's the essence of the problem.
You argue that words like efficiency and productivity are completely stripped of values, that it's possible for a nation to be poorer and more productive at the same time. So it makes productivity, you've come to believe, a very complex policy goal. But it's not totally useless, is it?
Not totally useless, but the problem is that productivity has become the justification for just about everything. Even something like the National Disability Insurance Scheme that we're putting together at the moment, the justification for that often is, oh, it'll increase productivity by 0.1% and make us all richer. Every single thing we do, we have to see that suburb over there where all those inefficient factories are. If we shut them, we'll increase national productivity, but we'll throw all these people out of work. The problem is that in some ways, we're enthralled to this idea of productivity as the answer for everything. Now, it's good to be more efficient, and there should be parts of our government which are all about making our economy more efficient. But the whole of our government, the whole of our economic policy, the whole of the Department of the Treasury should not be organised around the principle of raising productivity, because it's only one of a large number of measures that measure the worth of our economy and our society.
You say that when you were writing speeches for Labor leaders, you were constantly exhorted to put the word productivity into your speeches.
Well, I think the Department of Treasury, where I worked, has a fixation about the idea of productivity. And every time a speech would come down, I was Wayne Swan's speechwriter for some time, every time a speech would come to me, it would have a note on it: tell them about Krugman's line about productivity, which, of course, for those who don't know, is...
This is Paul Krugman, the international economist.
That's right, yes.
And frankly, a very progressive thinker, too.
Yes, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it's almost everything. This idea that if we don't increase productivity, make ourselves more efficient, you know, we'll all end up in the workhouse. And And this time after time after time, this was I was instructed to put this in speeches. And the problem that I had with that is that I thought that it stopped us thinking about wider issues to do with the economy and society that our political leaders had stopped thinking about because they were so obsessed with this narrow idea of productivity.
Dennis Glover's my guest, who's written a book which I whose title I think says it all, An Economy is Not a Society. So how would you, though, is there a risk that if you take the emphasis away from Australians trying to extend themselves, that we become a balkanised, just like Argentina did, for instance, that if the world is moving on and you even admit that you didn't, your father and your mother and you did not realise you were at the end of a 200-year industrial revolution, really, yeah. And just like the agricultural workers were displaced by the industrial revolution, is there not a risk that if you, in effect, have a bromide around your population, that you do slip back and that far more people end up in this plight of Doveton?
Well, no one's asking for us to put a bromide around our country. What I'm saying is that everybody has to modernise. Every country has to change. We all accept that. The question is, in what way do we change and modernise? I want you to think about Germany. Germany is a high-wage, high-cost economy. But Germany still makes cars, the best cars in the world, and everyone wants to drive one of their cars. That's because Germany wants to make cars, and because instead of using all of the benefits of their economic growth over the last decades in subsidising the purchase of housing and allowing people to buy housing and, you know, property portfolios, they've put their money into the base of a modern manufacturing economy through skills and building things and becoming a great engineering nation. In Australia, we're not doing that. We're bidding up the cost of our housing. We've squandered all of the hard work of those years of economic reform in becoming a bit of a rentier economy instead of a modern manufacturing economy with a real economic future.
Well, I suppose the argument would be, and look, I don't want to just play devil's advocate here, but the argument is that we're actually being exhorted to think about modern services, and that we've got some real comparative advantages here, and we could really employ people this way, and that in fact, people like you ought to get away from an obsession with modern manufacturing and making things, and start looking in another direction and become passionate and romantic about that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with services. You know, it's the engine room of our economy. The problem is that what appeals to me about manufacturing is this, that there's something inherently democratic and even social democratic about the idea of manufacturing, bringing large numbers of people together in factories, giving them skills, self-confidence. These sort of people tend to then organise themselves. They tend to get out and be leaders in their own communities.
They're institutions, you say, that have
yes.
A sort
well, look.
Heft.
Well, when you think back to the world that's gone, the world of the 60s and 70s and 80s in places like Doveton, it really is a different world out there. Not only were the factories physically present, but these factories had clubs. You know, they had football teams, cricket teams, fishing teams, golfing teams, 10-pin bowling teams. They were little communities that looked after ourselves. People had much more self-confidence. They were much more engaged in local politics, progress associations. There was something about this world of manufacturing that was good for society, good for the community. And now that's gone. We've been turned into sort of widgets in a service economy, and there's something here, like the guts has been kicked out of the strength of our communities. And I really think that there's enough. Why should we run away from manufacturing? Because manufacturing can actually be a quite modern and in very lucrative business want to get into it.
I was lobbied this recently at a lunch by a young man who was arguing precisely this, I must say, and he was arguing for hubs, and I want to do something about that in the future, sort of thinking manufacturing hubs. You just can't be there as a little factory on your own. Okay. You say there were five ways, we probably can't go through them all, but we should be thinking about the future. Thinking morally and historically, thinking about language, about sociology and aesthetics. In fact, you write that giving people the chance to live creative lives should be an important objective of public policy. Why?
Well, we've narrowed ourselves into thinking that the only thing that matters is making money, being efficient and making money. But there's so much more to our lives than simply going to work and having a job, or at least going to work and having a boring and efficient job. One of my heroes in the sort of social democratic movement is William Morris, who was a great socialist thinker, but also...
In the UK.
Yes, that's right. But also, of course, a great artistic producer, an architect, a revival of the Gothic movement. And Morris was absolutely insistent on this point that ordinary working people have the right to live in beautiful surroundings. And when I was growing up in Doveton, here was a community which was planned by post-war housing, constructors, to be a pleasant place where just even ordinary people could live a really nice life in beautiful, pleasant surroundings. Now we've let it be destroyed, and it's ugly, it's broken down. And the jobs that we do, I've had people who used to work in the factories making things, making beautiful cars, wonderful machinery, say to me that since the factories have shut, they're working in warehouses on the minimum wage as storemen and storewomen, and there's something about their lives just aren't as pleasant anymore because the work that they do isn't as creative, doesn't have as much point to it as it used to have. So what I'm saying is that work isn't just about making money. It satisfies so much more about our personality, our wish to be creative, our wish to have beauty around us, all of those things that everybody, not just art aficionados, who are highly educated, but ordinary people, working people, have the right to live in beautiful surroundings and be creative and be fully human. That's what I'm saying.
Yes, and you say it very well. It's very nicely written, Dennis, as a good speechwriter would, good historian. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Well, thank you, Geraldine. It's been my pleasure.
An economy is not a society. Winners and losers in the new Australia. And it is a publication. You can find it. It's a Redback publication. Yes, it is, published by Redpack, an imprint of Schwartz Publishing. So your thoughts, most welcome. I hope it's provoked some.